unless we manage to stabilize those, we will inevitably face new global temperature records and other consequences. Close quote. From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Hey, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker.
We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Chris Garlock.
And I'm Elise Bryant. March is Women's History Month. So on today's show, we're celebrating women's labor history.
The very first industrial strike in U.S. history was led by women workers, who inspired their less militant male comrades to then organize after them as well.
We'll visit with my good friend Bev Grant, who tells us the story behind her classic labor song, We Were There.
I was flipping through the script that I had and reading the part of Sojourner Truth. And she said, we have plowed and we have planted, we have gathered into barns. And I went, that's the beginning of a song.
Elise, you and the D.C. Labor Chorus will be performing We Were There next week, isn't that right?
That's right, Chris. Next Tuesday, March 12th, at the Tacoma Bus Boys. And Bev Grant herself, along with Carol Ann Solabello, will be on hand. Admission is free, but tickets are required. You can get them at laborheritage.org. Click on calendar. The doors open at 6:30 p.m.
Then you know I'll be there. Also on today's show, we've got Les Leopold and his brand new book, Wall Street's War on Workers, How Mass Layoffs and Greed Are Destroying the Working Class and What to Do About It.
How big a deal are mass layoffs in America? Answer, very big deal.
We'll have some of Ann Feeney's War on Workers to go along with that. And then the latest in our series in which folks share their favorite labor songs. Today's comes to us from Elisa McBride, Secretary Treasurer of American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I think you're going to be a bit surprised at her choice.
My favorite labor song is Electric Boogie, the 1989 remixed version of the Bunny Wailer tune performed by Marsha Griffiths. So hang in there, everyone, and I'll explain why.
Our final segment is from Labor History in Two.
The year was 1933. This was the day that Franklin Roosevelt named Frances Perkins Secretary of Labor.
Bev Grant is a musician, photographer, filmmaker, and union activist. After moving to New York City in the 1960s, Bev began performing and writing music in social movements, composing her first parody song for the 1968 Miss America protests in Atlantic City. She was involved throughout the 70s and 80s with the band Human Condition, which performed folk, rock, and world music and played a key role in New York City's underground music scene. Bev is the founder and director of the Brooklyn Women's Chorus. Much of her music writing has focused on the lives and labor conditions of the working poor. One of her best known songs is We Were There. Here's Bev with the story of how she wrote it.
But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories. We were there.
Back in 1991, I was invited to join the staff of the United Association of Labor Educators Northeast Union Women's Summer School, which is a leadership institute that meets every summer and invites rank and file and also other workers, non-union workers, to come and take classes in things like collective bargaining, leadership skills, arbitration, all to try to encourage them to become leaders in their unions. Well, I was hired as a cultural worker, which is unusual, and really my first experience where I felt actually integrated into a staff that took culture seriously and valued my input. That was extremely wonderful, something I'd been advocating for, but only recently had gotten in touch with the labor movement, because prior to that, my experience was as a social justice musician with a band called The Human Condition that lasted about 19 years. Going back to 1991, when I was invited, I met with the staff and went to my first school, where a woman named Flo Stern and a couple of other staff members had put together a program on women's labor history, which consisted of slides in the old-fashioned carousel with a slide, you know, you have to slip them in. Sometimes they fall out. It was not an easy thing to do. There was scripts, first-person narrative from people like Sojourner Truth and Mother Jones and some of the traditional labor heroines we're aware of. And it was a rather short program. And over the next couple years, I started adding music to it. And probably the second year or so, I was staying in a housing complex, a co-housing place in Amherst. And in my guest room where I stayed, I was flipping through the script that I had and reading the part of Sojourner Truth. And she said, in the script, "We have plowed and we have planted. We have gathered into barns." And I went, "That's the beginning of a song." And Flo Stern and I had talked about, wouldn't it be cool to name this show, we were there, after the book by Barbara Wertheimer, who was also a founder of the modern summer schools. The summer schools had existed early in the century as live-in schools for the summer for rank and file workers, giving women who had nothing a chance to actually be in the country, be in a school and learn. They were restarted, I think, in the 50s. And Barbara Wertheimer was one of the people. And a couple of people on the staff in the 90s were also founders, Lois Gray and Ida Torres, I think. The staff was made up of union leadership and union staff, as well as academics who worked in labor studies programs in the different universities. So we were up at UMass Amherst, University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I'm staying in this co-housing thing. And so here I write this, it just comes out. This song, it comes out. I feel like it was channeled. The song is called "We Were There."
We were there. From the textile mills in Lawrence to the sweatshops in New York, from the fields in California where our children had to work, jailed and beat our bodies, our spirits never died. We were there in the factory, we were there in the mills, we were there in the mines, then came home to fix the meals.
It's been a really important song for me. It has helped me build the show. It's the finale to the show, which now I do in many different locations, not just at the school. I did it for IBEW Local 3 this last year, and I do it at the school every year. I've done it for the UAW. I've done it for CLU. When Elise Bryant was president of CLU, she brought me out to Las Vegas, and we did the show there. And the show uses participants from who was ever at those schools or those events. The organizer is asked to cast it. I send the parts ahead of time, describe who the people are so they can try to match the roles with the people. And then they learn the song and they sing it at the end. And there are continual visuals happening. The show now lasts about an hour and 10 minutes or so and includes many characters. I'm constantly finding new characters, and depending on where this show takes place, I will develop a new character. If there's somebody that is close to either to the union or to that area that we want to highlight, it's new to me every time I do it because of that, and because the characters are always different, the people reading the parts. So it's become something I've been doing for over 30 years, and it's still brand new every time.
We were Polish, we were Irish, we were African and Jew, Italian and Latina, Chinese and Russian too. They tried to use our differences to split us all apart, but the pain we felt together touched the bottom of our heart. We were there in the factories.
It is probably one of my best known songs performed by other people, which is always an honor. And like I said, felt like it had been channeled. And it moves not only the people who hear it, but teaching the people the song is also a very moving experience, sometimes bringing tears, because often when women are reading these parts, they have no knowledge of women's labor history. And it's quite a rich history. And there are some amazing characters that are totally unknown to most people in this country. But I get to bring them up, get them out there, and people read these parts. I remember one time I did it, I think at Dartmouth, UMass Dartmouth, and a young student was doing the part, one of the parts, and she had this kind of lackadaisical manner and didn't seem really very into it at rehearsal. The rehearsal usually is just about an hour, and maybe right before the show or the day before. But she went home that night because the performance was the next night. And when she came back, she told me she had looked up this character and she was just full of enthusiasm for the part that she was playing. So it's rewarding. It's rewarding as a presenter to experience these kind of epiphanies that people have and the emotion it calls forth. I hope you like it.
We were there.
This is Carmen Rodriguez from El Desvío. At LACLA, we are proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
It's electric!
This is Elisa McBride, and I am the Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME, the union of 1.4 million members who provide public services to our communities. And my favorite labor song is Electric Boogie, the 1989 remixed version of the Bunny Wailer tune performed by Marsha Griffiths. So hang in there, everyone, and I'll explain why. Is the tune that we danced the electric slide to. And I first learned the electric slide from union members when I was 26 years old. And since then, I've danced the electric slide at union conventions, in parking lots, behind union halls, on a picket line, and even in a jail cell after being arrested for civil disobedience. And to me, the song is about power and solidarity and joy and pulling people in and being together. And just one lyric brings that up for me. Are you coming with me? So are you coming with me to organize, to build power, and to win for workers? I hope so.
You're listening to Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Next up, our friends at the Work Stoppage Podcast have put out an amazing multi-part series, Women in the U.S. Labor Movement. Here's a teaser from episode one. By the way, if you want to hear the entire series, find them at laborradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, folks, thank you for joining us on the start of yet another one of our ridiculous mega series. Very excited to get into this one. This was took a lot of research because, you know, we've covered a range of topics in our deep dives into labor history on our show. You know, we last year, for instance, we talked about the very few great general strikes in U.S. history going back all the way to 1892 in New Orleans. Running up through those last couple of citywide general strikes before the passage of the NLRA kind of consigned those to the past for now, at least. But, you know, we've also talked about some of the earliest strikes in U.S. history, specifically those that took place in the textile industry. And we've explored the history of mob involvement and government crackdowns on unions like the Teamsters and the International Longshoremen's Association. But one of the unfortunate themes running through those series, as well as really a lot of our coverage generally, is that, like most discussions of U.S. labor history, it's been overwhelmingly dominated by discussions of men, of male workers specifically, largely leaving out the entire, you know, other half of the working class, is a very large group of people known as women.
Right? It just reminds me of when we watched like The Irishman and some of the mob movies. I'm just like, these movies are not made for
everyone. There's just dudes and no one else. And it's you'd think that the human population was like 90% male. It's ridiculous.
The human population is mostly Danny DeVito's.
If you go by our various movie time episodes, you might get that impression. But, you know, while some of the reason behind this is that, you know, throughout U.S. history, there's been a lot of discrimination in hiring, especially in the past, where many jobs simply wouldn't hire women until recent decades. But that's not really a good excuse, because women have been part of the labor movement in the U.S. since before there was a labor movement in the U.S. So women being heavily involved or even leading the labor movement is not something that's only just happened recently. And so the relative lack of coverage of women in discussions of labor history really does all of us a really big disservice. You know, as we're trying to learn from our labor history in ways that we can use to advance our struggle today, if we leave out all of the incredible accomplishments that women workers have made, we're fighting with one hand tied behind our back. We're just not learning these really critical parts of our history that we need to inform our struggle today.
Yeah, we're letting half the sky fall down. Right.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so in this series, we're going to try and do a very small part in correcting this. And so drawing primarily from the giant reference work, which is itself a smaller version of an even bigger reference work, Women in the American Labor Movement by labor historian Philip Foner, we're going to work our way through the history of the U.S. labor movement over 200 years to try and fill in some of the major gaps in that history that are left in a lot of the broader, like, high-level histories that you see of the labor movement, which tend to be extremely male-centric. And so, you know, when we look back at our history from the very beginnings of capitalist development in the United States, women workers have not only been involved, but have been leaders. I mean, folks who have been longtime listeners to the show will know the very first industrial strike in U.S. history was led by women workers, who inspired their less militant male comrades to then organize after them as well. And for decades, even during periods of strong male chauvinism amongst a lot of male workers, time and time again, when we find successful workers' struggles, it's often been the women workers at the forefront, facing the harshest blows and carrying the heaviest burdens, which ultimately makes their omission from many labor histories all the more detrimental. And of course, a big part of the problem with this is that U.S. history overall is overwhelmingly dominated by bourgeois historiography, which tends to focus on individual elites, great man theory, and using ideology to explain the evolution of historical events. Labor history does tend to be a bit more materialist as a subfield of history, partially just because the people that go into it tend to be more left, closer to Marxism. And so that's good. But again, while we have innumerable works hailing the incredible legacies of male unionists like Eugene Debs, Bill Haywood, Harry Bridges, Walter Reuther, and dozens of others, equally important organizers like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Mother Jones, Dolores Huerta, and so many others have received far less attention. And so in this series, we're going to try and rectify that, highlighting the critical role that women workers have played and continue to play in the development of the labor movement and summarizing some of their many historic victories.
Hell yeah. So, I'm very excited to do this.
This is going to be a big undertaking. It's going to go on for a while. We're going to be here for at least a couple of months. So strap in and let's jump right into this.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
So kind of as I alluded to, you know, in the intro, we have had a chance to talk about the very earliest strikes in U.S. history on the show before, because some of our earlier episodes gave us a bit of a head start to jump in, because we've previously discussed the very first factory strike in U.S. history, the strike at the Slater Mill in Pawtucket, Rhode Island in 1824, where women weavers who were hired because the mill owners could get away with paying women significantly less than male workers responded to an attempt by the weavers of Pawtucket, which is a town that's just north of Providence, Rhode Island, where they had attempted to fix wages as a cartel. And so in response, the weavers are just like, well, okay, no, f*** you, and launched a walkout. And it took a week of mass protests because, of course, the bosses were not willing to just listen to the workers and accept that what they tried to do was f***ed up. So it took a week of mass protests and burning one of the mills down. But after that, the bosses were a lot more compliant and they were forced to cave and restore the workers' wages to what they had been before they decided to cut them as part of their wage fixing. Now, while that very first strike didn't then launch, you know, like the Textile Workers of America or a national union like that, it did inspire other workers across the country and really kicked off 200 years of industrial action in the United States. And like, it seems a pretty... important fact that this was led entirely by women workers. And yet again, whenever you see anything about labor history in the United States, it's the guy waving a hammer inside the Sparks and Steam factory. as Adam Johnson has said on Citations Needed, it's you would never know from most labor histories that, again, the leaders of the very earliest strikes in the U.S. were all women workers. And a big part of that is because of how the industrialization of this country really occurred, starting with the textile industry. Because textiles were the first real fully mechanized industry to develop on a mass scale in the U.S., which largely mirrors developments in Britain, whereas you had the steam engine was invented for mining. But mechanized industry really took off with textiles. And prior to the growth of industrial capitalism, most textile production was done on a home basis by women peasants. So you because the vast majority of everybody before the Industrial Revolution in at least Western society were subsistence farmers. You have a much smaller amount of folks who lived in towns who may have had some sort of trade, but the vast majority of people lived in farm families. And so you had the man in the family would be working on the farm, and then his wife would be heavily involved in household production of various commodities. Well, sorry, that's not true. Household production of various items used by the home, which sometimes would be commodities. Sometimes they would be produced for sale for money. But a lot of the times it was just producing the stuff that you needed, whether it was candles, whether it was clothing, whether it was simple items that you needed around. Or things that if you had the extra time, you could then sell to other people. That was kind of the bulk of a lot of that production. But once you could use steam-powered machinery or water-powered machinery to create a powered loom or powered spinning mule, you could crank out yarn, you could crank out cloth at a way, way, way faster and therefore cheaper rate. And so the industrial mills that were set up to do that starting in the 1790s in Rhode Island, they would then flood the market with all this cheap cloth. There's like, look at what we can make. It's so cheap. It's wonderful. And to a certain extent, it is. It's great. Now people can afford more cloth goods. They can afford more clothing. But the problem that results there for the women who had been making those goods in the past is, well, if you were making cloth goods at home for sale on the market, and now the industrial mills are flooding the markets with this cheap cloth, your market has now completely evaporated because there's no way you can compete with them. And so that destroyed the market for textile home goods, and that basically forced a huge swath of women who had previously produced these goods at home into the textile mills. And it's not just that the workers went from working for themselves to being directly exploited by their bosses that was so bad about this. It was that the conditions in the mills were nightmarish, as one woman weaver in New York City described in 1830.
Quote, Only think of a poor woman confined to her seat 15 hours out of 24 to make a pair of pantaloons for which she received only 25 cents. And indeed, many of them are not able to make such a pair in much less than 2 days. Only think of 12 and a half cents for making a shirt that takes a woman a whole day if she attends to any work in her family. There, a poor soul must sit all day in this dark weather and burn candles half her time and injure her health to lay in coal for the approaching winter. How shall she clothe her poor children or even feed them at this rate? Yet there are many poor women of my acquaintance that are placed in the disheartening situation I have mentioned, and many of them are widows with a number of children. And the tailors scold us when we bring home the work, and some of them say that the work is done ill and then take out half the price or give us nothing if they think fit. And at the same time, they sell their clothes much dearer than they did some time ago. And God help us, we have to submit to the injustice, end quote. Yeah, and like the wording there is definitely old timey.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be, these first couple episodes, we're dealing with stuff from 150, 200 years ago. So yeah, there's going to be, you'll be able to tell by the wording how old some of it is. But one of the other things, though, that I think is really interesting when you look back at these historical like labor conditions 200 years ago, is like how much labor we kind of take for granted today that is mechanized. Because now, you know, we have industrial textile mills that can burn out, you know, I don't know, thousands and thousands and thousands of shirts a day. I mean, I don't know. It's maybe I'm underselling it there. But at this point, you know, again, this is somebody working maybe at one loom that's got like that's belt driven from steam power, or just something that's foot powered if it's in like a sweatshop situation, which were extremely common. And yet they're paid jack. Like, you don't even need to know the inflation rate. We'll get into that when we get into some more details about money. But like, even you don't have to, it's like, we're going to pay you 12 and a half cents for making a shirt that took you a whole day. Like, you don't have to know how much cents were worth back in 1830 to know that that's like nothing for an entire day's work. Like,
yeah, I mean, just think they're like, penny is the smallest division of a dollar. And so like, things never really got cheaper than that.
Well, yeah. And to her point in that quote, you know, she's talking about working 15 hours a day. And so like, you're making less than a penny an hour with this sort of, like, that's how bad conditions were 200 years ago. And it sets the stage, I think, partially. One thing that I really think that learning labor history really helps burst your bubble for right away is any sort of this very commonly used nostalgia for a time when things were simpler and better for workers. No,
right?
Since the beginning of capitalism, it has been terrible and has just continued to be terrible in new and different ways.
Yeah, and we see to move to today, the innovations, quote unquote innovations in like AI, it is just another example of the quote unquote progress that is then just wielded against workers to deteriorate our conditions.
Right, exactly. Well, and the other thing, though, too, that I want to highlight from her quote, and we'll see this time and time again with the way that women workers were disrespected quite a bit more than men, is the point where she talks about, like, where if she would have to take the work home to finish it at the end of the day and then bring it back, and sometimes they'd just be like, no, that's not good enough. We'll take it and we'll sell it, but we're not paying you anything. Like, yeah, bosses absolutely screwed over male workers, but most bosses would be worried if you tried that, you know, you might face some violence. And so this is another thing where you see like violence rooted in this, because you have a lot of these bosses who think, and we'll see this time and time again throughout this, who think that women workers will not stand up for themselves. And that like, that's a way that they can add another way to oppress women workers. And you know, the crushing parts of our society, is such as all of the various forms of ingrained misogyny that exist, sometimes like put a lot of pressure on these women workers not to fight back, which is again all the more reason to me why it's so important to tell these stories and show that even 200 years ago, as misogynist and patriarchal a society as this the US A is now and B absolutely was then, you still had people from the get-go being like, no, this isn't okay. You can't pay people these wages that nobody can survive on. We have to fight back. And so, like, it exposes the lie behind the any idea that, like, class struggle is a new thing, that it's, like, this is something that only happened recently, or that, like, that workers are only stirred up by outside agitators. It's, like, from the minute there's been industrial capitalism in the U.S., there's been pushback, there's been strikes, there's been organizing.
As I went to walking on a fine summer's morning, the birds on the bushes did whistle and sing. The lads and the lassies in couples were sporting. Then back to the factory, their work to begin. I saw one amongst them, she was fairer than any. Her cheeks like the roses that bloom in the spring. Her skin like the lily that grows in yon valley. She was only a hard-working factory girl. To her more closely to view her, when on me she cast a look of disdain, saying, young man, stand off me and do not come near me. I work for my living and think it no shame. The next morning I was there, ready and waiting, and bade her to talk to me just for a spell. And each morning after she lingered still longer, and then hurried away at the sound of the bell. Birds on the bushes were stricken and still. So I stepped on the path where she often did meet me, and I walked to the factory up on the hill. The crowd gathered round, couldn't hide the destruction. I cast my eyes on it in such disbelief. A truth of the world settled into the ashes. The rich man's neglect is the poor man's grief. As I stood there, a whisper, it did caress me. A faint scent of roses, my senses begun. I lifted my face and I saw that above me a thousand young butterflies darkened the sun.
Hey, this is Lena from the Work Stoppage Podcast. We're a proud part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, more than 200 labor radio and podcast shows across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where the people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day a house fire claimed the life of a true champion for working people. Lucy Gonzalez Parsons was born in Texas. Most of her childhood is a mystery, but it is thought she was born into slavery and was African American, Mexican American, and Native American. After the Civil War, she met and married a Confederate soldier, Albert Parsons. The couple had to leave Texas because they were in danger due to their anti-segregationist activism. They came to Chicago, where they became involved in the city's labor movement. Albert edited The Alarm, a newspaper for working people. Lucy helped to write for the paper. Together, they supported the fight for the 8-hour workday, giving speeches throughout the city. Albert was one of the 8 men tried for the bombings at a workers' rally at Chicago's Haymarket Square in 1886. Although it was clear he was not even present when the bomb was thrown, Albert was convicted and hanged. After losing her beloved husband, Lucy kept up the fight for working people. She was a founding member of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. She continued to speak and write for the causes of women's rights and workers' rights. Because of her activism, the Chicago police called her more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. In 1915, she helped to lead a hunger march of thousands of people in Chicago. At the march, the iconic labor song Solidarity Forever was sung for the very first time.
Solidarity forever.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we start. Calling the shots.
Les Leopold is executive director of the Labor Institute, a nonprofit organization that designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics for unions, worker centers, and community organizations. He's written a number of books, including How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Financial Elites Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It, and The Man Who Hated Work and Loved Labor, The Life and Times of Tony Mazzocchi. In his latest book, just released 2 weeks ago, Les shows how healthy corporations in the United States have used mass layoffs and stock buybacks to enrich shareholders at the expense of employees. It's called Wall Street's War on Workers, How Mass Layoffs and Greed Are Destroying the Working Class and What to Do About It. We spoke to him on Tuesday.
The book focuses on five questions. So let me just take them one at a time. First question, how big a deal are mass layoffs in America? Answer, very big deal. There are 20 million mass layoffs between 1996 and 2012 recorded by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then they stopped that database. If you just prorated that forward, we're way over 30 million now. If you add in households, you're probably talking about more than half of the American working population has experienced the trauma of mass layoffs, and the trauma is very severe. We have all kinds of health data on what happens. That's question number one. Question number two, do mass layoffs impact politics? It turns out that they do. We did a very careful study of the blue wall states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and we found that as the mass layoff rate went up in a given county, the vote for the Democratic Party went down. This was very statistically significant. That's question number two. Yes, they impact politics. Question number three, wait a second. Maybe there are other things that impact politics coming from the working class. So for example, yes, maybe they experience all these mass layoffs, but what they're really reacting to is a rising sense of racism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, what Hillary Clinton called the basket of deplorables who voted for Trump. Is that the case? Answer, no. We also looked at 23 different social issue questions with these very large voter surveys, not like these polls you see before elections like now. These are things that run for years. And we found that the white working class has actually gotten more liberal, not more illiberal, over the last several decades. Like a question about homophobia went from 30% supporting adoption of gay couples adopting kids to now well over 70%. Same thing on legalization of immigrant workers. It's very clear that racism is not why those folks abandon the Democratic Party. Okay, fourth question. Are these forces that cause mass layoffs inevitable, i.e. technology, the progress of technology and globalization, that there's really nothing we can do about it? Workers just have to move from the jobs that are disappearing to the jobs that are emerging. Answer, no. That in fact, there are very specific causes from Wall Street that lead to mass layoffs, primarily leverage buyouts and stock buybacks. And leverage buyouts have happened to tens of thousands of firms, and almost every time there's a layoff that follows. And often, there's a much higher level of bankruptcy that take place in these firms as well. In the book, we show that AI is, people have been yelling about technology destroying jobs for generations, really. And it's a slow process, but the mass layoffs are a rapid process. Even in the tech industry, there were 250,000 layoffs in the tech industry last year, another 40 to 50,000 since January 1 of this year, none of them having to do with technology, all of them having to do with stock buybacks, getting the money to do stock buybacks, which enrich executives and chief investors. It's really remarkable. Okay, fifth and final question, what do we do about it? There is a policy dimension, there's a movement building dimension. The policy dimension is we really have to outlaw stock buybacks and greatly limit leverage buyouts. This was discussed by the Democratic Party, the leverage buyouts in the mid-80s, and was abandoned by the new Democrats and by the Wall Street lovers in the Democratic Party that just couldn't get enough of deregulation. It's a disaster, and it can be done. But the problem is, how do you build a movement that's sufficiently strong enough to take on Wall Street? And that question starts with stop blaming the white working class for being something they are not. That if mass layoffs became the center, stopping mass layoffs became the center of a progressive movement, working people would run towards it. But instead, we're pushing them away because we think they're not quite liberal enough on all the social issue questions. And we make that sort of a litmus test.
It's a war on child labor protection. It's a war on the 8-hour day. It's a war on occupational health and safety. It's a war on social security. Now, thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF, and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time. We started calling the shots.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1933. This was the day that Franklin Roosevelt named Frances Perkins Secretary of Labor. Secretary Perkins was the first woman to hold a cabinet position in the United States government. Perkins brought to her position years of experience advocating for working people. Born in Boston, Perkins attended Mount Holyoke College. She moved to Illinois to become a school teacher. She began spending time at the renowned Hull House Settlement House. At Hull House, Perkins encountered some of the leading fighters for women's rights and workers' safety, while learning from many of the leading labor reformers of her day. From Illinois, Perkins returned east to study economics and sociology, earning her master's degree from Columbia University in New York City. Soon, Perkins became the head of the National Consumers League. While in New York, Perkins witnessed firsthand the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire tragedy. She watched as 146 young girls and women jumped to their deaths to escape the deadly flames, because the doors of the factory were chained shut. The experience profoundly affected Perkins. She would later say the New Deal began on March 25, 1911, the day the Triangle factory burned. She spent the rest of her career working to ensure the conditions that led to the Triangle fire would not be repeated. Perkins played a key role in crafting many parts of Roosevelt's New Deal legislation, including the passage of the Social Security Act. She also worked to pass the National Labor Relations Act, which allowed millions of workers to earn collective bargaining rights for the first time. During her 12 years as labor secretary, Perkins forged new ground for the role of women in government as a staunch ally for working people. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
You're listening to Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Hey, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, we'd love to hear them. Drop us a note at info@laborheritage.org.
Special thanks this week to the Work Stoppage Podcast, which has now put out 5 episodes of their Women in the U.S. Labor Movement series. You can find them at laborradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. Today's show is produced by me, Chris Garlock,
and engineered by Mark Nocella and Kalia Chapman, right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. Music today included We Were There by Bev Grant and the Brooklyn Women's Chorus,
War on the Workers by Ann Feeney,
and Electric Boogie by Marsha Griffiths.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour,
the art and soul of the American labor movement.
We'll see you next week.
Be there. Aloha.
Yeah, that could be a good sign, huh?
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The involuntary manslaughter trial of James Crumbly, the father of the Michigan student who killed four Oxford High classmates in 2021, started today with opening arguments and initial witnesses. Crumbly faces four counts of involuntary manslaughter, which are the same charges on which his wife, Jennifer Crumbly, was convicted a month ago. She was the first parent in the United States to be held criminally accountable for a school shooting. Their son, Ethan Crumbly, is serving a life sentence. Jason Crumbly purchased a gun with his son just 4 days before the shooting. No one says he knew what his son planned to do with the gun, but prosecutors allege that his gross negligence was a cause of the violence. The House of Representatives last night approved six spending bills totaling $460 billion, a crucial step toward funding federal agencies for the next 6 months and preventing a partial shutdown this weekend. The legislation passed by a 339-85 vote and heads to the Senate, which must pass it by midnight Saturday to keep crucial agencies from shutting down when funding lapses. The bill, which was drafted by bipartisan leaders in both chambers, is not expected to face substantial opposition. Meanwhile, lawmakers are negotiating a second package of six bills, including defense, in an effort to have all federal agencies fully funded before a March 22 deadline, and lawmakers remain fiercely divided over how to fund these remaining agencies and which policies to attach to that legislation. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed a bill last night protecting in vitro fertilization providers from the fallout of a state Supreme Court ruling that equated frozen embryos to children. Services were then halted at some of the state's largest fertility clinics. The legislation will shield IVF providers from lawsuits or criminal charges over the, quote, death or damage to an embryo, close quote, during the IVF process. Doctors from at least one clinic said they would resume IVF services today. The bill, however, does not specify whether frozen embryos created through IVF have the same rights as children under state law. For that reason, some legal experts and reproductive rights advocates worry it does not go far enough. And a federal judge in Texas ruled this week that the Minority Business Development Agency, created during the Nixon administration, must serve disadvantaged entrepreneurs of all races and ethnicities, including whites. Siding with white business owners who sued the agency for discrimination, Judge Mark T. Pittman said the agency's mission to help disadvantaged business owners owned by blacks, Hispanics, and other racial and ethnic groups gain access to capital and contracts violates the rights of all Americans to receive equal protection under the Constitution. The agency's attorneys argued that its mission to help disadvantaged businesses owned by these racial and ethnic groups is constitutional because it helps correct past discrimination in which the government played a role. Tuesday's ruling underscores the impact of the Supreme Court's landmark decision last year that said colleges and universities could no longer take race into consideration as a specific basis for granting admissions, and was the latest in a string of court decisions